Welcome to Financial Planning for Oil and Gas Professionals, hosted by certified financial planners Justin Brownlee and Jared Machen of Brownlee Wealth Management, the only podcast dedicated to those of you in the oil and gas profession to help you optimize investments, lower future taxes, and grow your wealth. Learn more and subscribe today at BrownleeWealthManagement.com.
Welcome back to another episode of FPOG, Financial Planning for Oil and Gas Professionals. This week on the podcast, we're doing something a little bit different. We have retired founder joining us. Retired founder is very active on X or Twitter, and you can find him there. And he talks about his journey as a basically retired tech founder who's well past the level of financial freedom, and he's searching for and really finding how do you engage in a meaningful life full of purpose and meaning after you've checked the box for financial freedom. And so welcome, retired founder. Would love to have you just introduce yourself to our community.
Hey, thanks for having me, Justin. Yeah, so to just square any awkwardness, I don't use my real name, not because I'm wanted by the law or I'm hiding for anyone. I just don't seek any special attention for me as an individual. So My Twitter handle is retired founder, and I just operate by that. You know who I am. Anyone I speak with who wants to reach out, I'm glad to introduce myself. But it helps me be more authentic. It helps me tell stories about people that probably don't want to be included in your podcast that you may be able to triangulate if I were using my own name. So that's me. Just quick history. I'm a middle class kid from the Midwest. I went to public schools. I've been a salesman by trade, always a hustler. I cut grass, I shoveled snow. I was the kid that was going door to door selling stuff early in life. So always been motivated by financial rewards. Met my wife at the University of Texas. We've been married for 30 years in July, three adult kids. Sold my first company in the late 90s for a small amount of money, which allowed me to start another company in 2003. That we sold in chunks to private equity in 2017, 2020, and 2022. So based in Austin, I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona today. We split time between here and Texas and Big Sky, Montana. So as you mentioned, I'm still trying to find meaning and fulfillment and replace the identity and purpose and structure that I had as an entrepreneur for 15 years. That's me in a nutshell. Thanks for having me.
I love that. We're excited to have you on. And I think for our audience, what drew me to your Twitter account was something that I found with almost every client we have as they enter retirement. And so the background there is so many of our clients head into retirement and they've been working for 40 years, sometimes 45 or 50 years. And so then they go into this life stage where work's no longer a part of their life. And after about 12 or 18 months, we have a lot of clients that find any way possible to go back into work. And so this idea of I'm financially free, and whether it's, you know, a eight-figure balance sheet or a nine-figure balance sheet or more, when you check that box for financial freedom, sometimes you think, okay, I've done it. Work is now gone. But you then come back and you're thinking, work was such a big part of my life, and how do I fill that? And I know we're going to touch on that a bunch, but I would just use this as almost a quick advertisement. Highly recommend you follow Retired Founder on X or Twitter. It's really fun to engage in that discussion. But first question up for us today, what was your first memory of money?
Oh, that's a good one. My dad, I don't know if there's a clinical level for workaholic, but my dad was a worker. He was an accountant, and he was gone in the morning. He would get home, you know, in time to sit down for dinner for a minute, and then he'd go in the basement and work. So I think it was modeled to me that money was very important. It must have been important, right? If dad's going to spend all of his waking hours working, it's got to be important. So I question that sometimes, whether I was born with a gene that was attracted to money or the things that come along with money, or whether it was modeled to me. I guess my first memory was, you know, doing jobs, hustling around the house, you know, doing cleaning or laundry or something for mom for a quarter. And I remember having a goal to have $10 squirreled away. And so I think that'd be the very earliest.
That's fascinating. What would you say, you know, obviously you're sitting here now, you've been a part of really substantial exit events, liquidation events. What would you say was your favorite part of that journey? Oh, by the way, sorry, before you answer, retired founder chose for us to not send him any of these questions prior. So I'm excited for this. Every single time we have a guest on the podcast, we send the questions beforehand because I want their input. Is there anything we should add that can be more valuable to our audience? What's fun about this one is retired founder is taking these questions totally blind, totally live. So I'll repeat this question. You know, you've had quite a journey. What was your favorite part of this process, favorite part of the journey for you?
You're talking about the post-exit journey, or are you talking about from being a paper boy in when I was 10?
I would start paper boy when you're 10 all the way to post-exit, favorite part of the entire journey.
Okay. I'll try to segment them. And the way life works is you don't know when you're at peak until after. So if I'm looking back on my career, there's a few highlights where I just didn't know I was in the right spot. Of course, being a kid, you know, you have no responsibilities and no one's counting on you for anything. So that was great. High school was great. But of course you're striving to get to the next level. So you don't appreciate it at that time. In retrospect, my favorite time at the company I founded in 2003 was when we were about 8 or 10 people. And the company was big enough that I knew we were going to make it, or it felt likely that we were going to make it. We were starting to break even about 5 years in, still only 10 employees. And we all knew each other really well. And there was a high level of trust and a high level of commitment. And I think the company was working as well as it could work when we were that very small size. Then you get to 20, and then you get to 40, and then you get to 80, and you've hired somebody that has feelings you don't understand. And things don't go as well. If we talk about post-exit, my favorite part was the first 6 months. I ran the company. We sold to a private equity firm in 2017, and I ran the company for about a year and then just ran out of gas. And I was so happy my first 6 months. I caught up on my sleep, which, by the way, is the best part of retirement. Your listeners probably know anyone that's retired. No one tells you the best part is the sleep. I went 15 years where I wasn't, I think, in a deep sleep. I was, you know, somewhat working while unconscious.
Fascinating.
But in 6 months, you know, I bought a jet airplane. I bought a couple of houses. I remember once sitting down to listen to the Fleetwood Mac Rumors album. And I thought, I'm just going to listen to music. Have you ever listened to music? You're a young man. Like, have you ever just sat down and listened to an album? It's wonderful.
It's hard to do that because my youngest is still 5 years old. I remember doing that before kids, and I dream of, you know, being able to do that again at some point.
Yeah. So I think it was that 6 months. I was really having a lot of fun. I mean, we had everyone won. Everybody was happy. Things were going well. So I didn't have any post-exit ennui or angst about structure and meaning and purpose and identity. So I think that was my favorite part.
That's great. What would you say was the lowest part of your journey before any of the liquidation events?
Oh gosh, the first 4 years of running the business, we were software as a service, rather before it was a category. I was a salesman by trade, selling software. And you may be a little young, but back in the day, you would sell software, so you wouldn't do it on a subscription. You'd maybe get $100,000 for your product, and you'd charge a small maintenance fee. But since we were two people with no track record, no customers, no office, no nothing, we started renting the software. So it took a long time to build, Our first year in business, we did $9,920 of revenue on a PO we got at the end of December. That was a big day. So it was really, really, really hard. Had a young family, very supportive wife, who helped get through, but those were dark days. Those were, if I had a lifeboat, I would have climbed in it.
That's incredible. And funny you mentioned that. My first full year in business, my tax return showed, I believe, about $9,000 in income. And so I know exactly what you're talking about. I know those conversations with the wife, and they're hard, but they're fun to look back on today, but they are very hard at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. A little survivor bias there. That's another observation is, you know, those hardest moments are the ones you look back on most fondly if you succeed. And we were fortunate and lucky enough to succeed, but having a supportive wife goes a long way.
Absolutely. What was the lowest part of your journey after some of the liquidation events had happened and after you were, you know, well beyond financial independence?
Yeah. And so another reason that I'd like to be anonymous is I can just share numbers if you don't mind me sharing numbers.
That'd be great.
I always thought my number was $10 million. I thought if I had $10 million somehow in this business, I'd be done. And that would be plenty for me to live on. When we sold to a private equity company and I was able to roll equity, meaning I sold part of my stake and I got to so take some chips off the table and leave some chips in the casino. So first check was for $21 million. I was done, or it was, you know, it was enough, more than I had planned on. And then I guess things went well because the next check was 40, low 40s, and the final check was upper 20s. So kind of overshot the mark. And the, you know, back to your question, the low point was after the second check, I guess before the third, when I had bought four houses and a jet, and I had remodeled our house. So I had a place in the city, I had a place on the beach, I had a place in the mountains, I had a place in the desert, and I ran out of things to do and I realized I wasn't happy at all. I was thoroughly unsatisfied. I had maybe some kind of an instinct where even though I was retired and I had banked enough money to be safe, I needed to, you know, set up these houses and, you know, and then as soon as I get the theater working right, then I'm going to be happy. And then as soon as I get the, whatever, the floors redone and the whatever else project was done. And when I finished all of that, I was just pretty miserable. We, you know, two homes is the right number of homes, by the way, for anyone who's thinking about buying homes. You go to a house, especially those that are sitting on the ocean and you haven't been there for a couple months and everything's broken. And I found myself, I guess, frustrated. I was angry. I felt a bit, maybe this sounds awful, but it's okay. I'm anonymous. Felt like the world owed me something. I felt like I bartered my life. I bartered my family's life to put in this effort and be not present at my kids' soccer games and plays and things like that. And I somehow won, and it just wasn't what I was expecting. And that happened about 3.5 years into retirement, where I really started asking myself the questions maybe I was afraid to ask before about what am I missing, what were the assumptions that I had incorrect, and why is this not the way it appeared to be on the brochure?
Where would you say you're at as you wrestle with those questions? What are some of the either answers to those questions, or you may not have answers and you may just have more questions?
Yeah. So to disappoint all the anybody listening, I don't have the answers. But I learned an awful lot about the questions. Someone pointed me to an article published by A.J. Wasserstein. I don't know if you've seen it. He's a professor at Yale, and it's called The Post-Exit Paradox of Success. I'm butchering the title, but something like that. That led me to hire a coach named Rick Eigenbrode. And I've got about 50 pages of handwritten notes from my sessions with Rick. And it's amazing to look back in the beginning how lost and frustrated and angry I was. And he really helped me unpack what happened. And, you know, what happened was a misalignment of expectations. And they seem so juvenile when I talk about it a few years later. But I under-indexed how much I valued the structure, the meaning, the purpose, the identity of who I was as a CEO and a founder of a software company. I just didn't think, I thought it was a means to an end. I was in it for the money. I got the money. And I thought, okay, I can shed this now. And I really under-indexed that. The second part that I had wrong was thinking that somehow the universe would identify me as special and that I wouldn't have the problems that normal people had. And it turns out you still get called for jury duty. My parents still got old and needed to get moved into a retirement home. And for the life of me, when my smoke detector battery goes low, it chooses 2 a.m. to beep every time. Every time. There's nothing about your bank account that those 9-volt batteries give a damn about. So the universe just didn't care. And the third thing that I had objectively wrong when retiring was the quantity of high quality offers I would have for my time. I thought my company that I built with my own two hands and ran for 15 years would need me a little more. And they were very respectful. This is not a sob story at all. I could go in and have lunch and shake hands all day long, but I really wasn't very involved in the business. So I definitely misread that. The other thing that you think you're going to do, two things that people always talk about are sitting on boards and doing nonprofit work. And that may be great for some people, but my quick experience, sitting on a board is awful. It's just awful. And it's right there in the name, right? Sit on a board. I'm a founder. I'm an operator. Like I don't want to watch other people do stuff. I like to do stuff. So sitting in a room for 6 hours watching somebody run through PowerPoint is a special version of hell that I didn't expect. So the quality of offers was lower. And nonprofit work sounds so good in concept, but you can either chuck money into the ocean with very good causes. Nothing wrong with the Red Cross, nothing wrong with, supporting, your nonprofits, but it just doesn't feel very satisfying for someone who's used to being a little closer to the metal, I guess is the way I would describe it. And if you try to get a little closer to a nonprofit, which we've done and we've supported some in the animal welfare area, they're slow and it's just difficult to watch. So sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but that's really the base of it. Those are the things that I had wrong going in, and that was the source of my discontent.
Absolutely. Okay. You had a low, in those first 4 years of business, then you had a low post-exit. Which low was worse, with money or without money?
Boy, that's a question I should have had in advance. I had to think about that. That's easy. The lower was without money. The lower was without money. I was in peril of losing my house, my everything. And that's, I shouldn't have even paused. That's having money and not knowing what to do with it is a much higher class problem, and a unique problem, and not a, I'm not alone in that particular problem, but it's not something you can, find a book to write about retirement angst or replacing your meaning and purpose if you've run a company or been an executive or, I don't know, maybe an athlete, or if anyone's watching, you can see Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon behind me, the types of letdown you have afterward. So it's a world's smallest violin problem that here I am, I got everything I wanted, and now I'm kind of lost. And I could tell you how I would respond if me of 10 years ago would have heard me talking on this podcast. I'd be screaming at the guy on the screen thinking, what a moron.
Yeah.
Give me a chance. Let me show you how it's done, idiot. But it's just not as neat and easy as that. It wasn't for me anyway.
For sure. That makes a lot of sense. I'm really curious to get your thoughts on this. Do you think that there is a line at which more money doesn't really add to life satisfaction? And if so, what is it? Is it 5 million? Is it 10 million like you thought? Or is it a different number?
So in general, you have enough when you say you have enough. And that's the only measurement there is. I have a friend who's a multi-billionaire, not a close friend, but someone I know. And his line is, he's running 10 different businesses. And his line is, when I'm dead, I'm going to get cremated and they're going to put the urn on my desk and then I'll think about retiring. And that's natural for him. It's happy for him. Yeah. That's his place. As I've developed a small following on Twitter, I've talked to people who have exited with, less than $10 million and they're just totally sated. They have everything they need, don't need to work, don't think about it. So definitely independent. We use a model where we try to spend or give away 3% of our investment portfolio annually, which is a conservative, if you run the Monte Carlos, it's a very conservative amount, but it becomes challenging for us to spend. That doesn't mean other people who have more expensive tastes, if you're into private islands or buying a sports team, something like that, there's always another level. For us, it's, we have enough. And I know that, but doesn't mean you don't think about it. Doesn't mean you wouldn't appreciate having more.
Absolutely. I love that idea of enough. What would you say you really enjoy spending money on? And are there things that you really enjoyed spending money on throughout the entire process with and without money?
All right. This is going to sound awful, but I'm going to say it anyway. So my career was in sales. I flew 1,000,000 miles in the back of the airplane in economy, domestically. Yeah. I didn't get 1,000,000 miles flying to Asia. I got 1,000,000 miles flying from Dallas to Omaha, you know, 620 miles at a clip. So the vision I always had was I was not going to fly commercial anymore. I was going to buy a jet and bypass all that. So the most egregious spend I have in a year is with NetJets. And I love it. I just love it. Not recommending it. I have friends that have more money than me that fly Southwest. I'm not doing it anymore. I mean, it's hard to get around the amount. From a kid who once was striving to save $10, I now spend about $3 per second flying. So it's hard to get around, but that's definitely it. The things that, I don't know, I guess the things that were not as pleasant to spend money on or when I feel like I'm really wasting or reaching or just spending to spend. We like giving money away. We like handing people cash. I like being able to go to the grocery store and buy whatever I want without thinking about, is that a good price on strawberries or a bad price on strawberries? So the little things are nice.
Absolutely. It's timely that you mentioned that. One of our recent episodes was with Preston Holland on the topic of private aviation. And, you know, when you talk about flying private, it makes a lot of sense if you own your own business. There's tax advantages. It's much, much easier to structure it that way. It's a little bit trickier when you don't and you just have a nest egg and you're spending it. So I will ask one follow-up question, which is not the purpose of this podcast, but do you have thoughts on why NetJets versus buying a plane, hiring a team of pilots and maintenance managers and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're probably right. If you were in a situation where you were going to fly a couple hundred hours a year, which is a lot, and be able to write it off as an expense, maybe you're moving from small city to small city, moving teams of people around, you can probably torture a spreadsheet long enough until it'll admit it's a good idea. When you're flying for yourself, being a founder and an optimizer, of course, I was trying to work all of the fat out of the system, which is why we bought a plane and put it into a charter fleet to begin with. The thing that you cannot put a number on in a spreadsheet is head trash. And when you own an airplane, you have a dumpster of head trash at all times. So why is the plane sitting in Indianapolis for 10 days? What happened to the pilot? What do you mean a tray table costs $23,000? like wow. All of these things that just make you angry were not worth it to me. We also tried, and I'll put in a plug for NetJets. They've been great for me. Everything you do in private aviation is a discount to NetJets. NetJets is certainty. You can. I've done a dry lease. I've done wheels up. I've done brokers. I've done advanced funds put in with local operators and other operators. You know, if you work with a local operator, we've got one in Montana. We had one in Scottsdale. We had one in Austin. You know, they've got 10 or 15 planes they're running around, and you know, if you can get one, it's great. And if a red light comes on that plane, or the owner decides they want it, you're not flying. And you're just at the mercy. And, you know, some of the medium-sized operators, maybe they've got 50 planes, 100 planes. NetJets has 1,000 planes. They do their own maintenance. They don't rent them out. It's owners that are on the planes. And if something goes wrong, which is knock on wood, it has only happened one time, we were able to replace a plane without a delay. So anyway, unsolicited advertisement for NetJets. Everything, and it is slightly more expensive than the alternatives. But if you're looking for certainty, then that's the one I would recommend.
I think that strikes at a principle that's critical. Now, you know, obviously we're talking about private aviation, but still, every person regardless of having $10 or $10 billion, you have to make decisions on, am I going to optimize for return on my money to the extreme nth degree, or am I optimizing for life? Am I optimizing for something else? And there is always, you know, reason to say, yeah, it's really expensive. And maybe that means my kids are going to inherit $3 million less than they otherwise would have. But it's going to be okay. And they're still going to inherit a lot. And so I love that thought process. You don't optimize everything for ROI.
It's hard to make that switch, but you're absolutely right. I have a friend that says, if you don't fly private, your kids will. So,
ooh, man, that's good.
So why not? Yes. But yeah, that's a tough pill to swallow. That's our largest budget item, on an annual basis, to each his own. You know, you may want to have, you know, a bigger house. You may want to have a yacht. You may want to have an island. You may want to have a sports team. You may be perfectly happy in the house. You know, you've been in for 20 years driving a beat up Honda Accord. I mean, run your own race. And my race involves NetJets. For better or worse, involves NetJets.
That's great. Perfect segue into this next question. What is your desired outcome in terms of your children's inheritance? What lessons do you want them to learn about money?
Oh, wow. This is a tough one. I think it's Charlie Munger that says, you know, when it comes to giving money to your kids, you can give them money and ruin them, or you can not give them money and have them hate you. So it's probably better to give them money and ruin them. And
that's a great quote.
I don't have the answer for this one. I wish I did. I can tell you I have a friend who has a structure that I think makes sense that I'm not currently set up for. So we have everything you would expect us to have. We have a, you know, 2-inch thick document somewhere in a safe. And if my wife and I die, you know, trusts kick in and lawyers are summoned. I'm not sure what happens. It's structured to try to, you know, make sure the most money gets passed through. But it's missing the point. You know, if my kids received a third of our, we have 3 kids, so, you know, each get 30 some million dollars, it would ruin them. I really think it would ruin them. So the structure that I've heard that I think makes the most sense would be for our kids, your mileage may vary, others' mileage may vary, would be having some kind of a trust that distributed the equivalent of a middle-class income to them annually without risk. So in this world, you tell me, you know, maybe it's a $5 million trust or something like that for $3 million trust a piece that is able to spit out 80, 100 grand a year. So they'll always eat. They'll always have healthcare. They'll always have a place to live. And the other interesting thing that this person implemented was the balance of that money was to be given away to a nonprofit at the kid's discretion within, I think he had a 2 or 3 year horizon on that. So the rest of the money, the bulk of the money would be given away, but the kids would be able to determine where it went. I shouldn't say that's the best. I should say that's the least bad plan that I've heard.
Very interesting. I am always so fascinated to hear just different perspectives on this. And there's not really a right answer is the thing. I've talked to folks that want their children to receive everything at 21. And as you can imagine, most folks don't have that opinion. And so there's just not a right answer.
There's not. And we also believe in the concept of helping them earlier. So if, you know, statistically, my wife and I, one of us will be alive probably in 40 years and our kids will be in their 60s and 70s. What good does money do them, you know, when they're 70, really? Isn't it better to dole out money, you know, in advance, help them get a nicer place, help them get a nicer car, help them get a start in life? So we do that as well. And that's a separate thread I won't pull on now, but, you know, it depends on the kid and the stage of life that they're at. But I don't have any desire to be the person that's going back to the lawyer every 6 months based on the last conversation they had with their kid.
Yeah, that's such a good thought. I want to follow, and maybe this is our ending point. There may be some follow-up questions from this, but I'm really interested to hear in your situation. You know, obviously it's a unique situation. It's not a path that most people experience. So do you have people in your life who have had a similar experience? And I guess a blunt way to ask this question, who do you get advice from?
I got the best advice from my coach. Again, his name is Rick Eigenbrod. He wrote a book that was transformative to me, and I forgot the name of it. But it's the Paradox of Success. I believe it's subtitled "What Happens When You Get What You Want." And he was the most useful for me, not as a peer, but as someone who had worked with a group of people who had retired early, retired wealthy. And so I was able to absorb, 20 years of knowledge from him. And the best teachings I'll share with you, you know, a year worth of therapy. One was to put away the inclination to go do something bigger and better. And that's a tough pill to swallow, because the world in some ways expects you, you know, you've done this. Now what are you going to do? Hey, you walked on the moon, Buzz Aldrin. What are you going to do next? And it's hard to follow. It's hard to have a follow-up act, especially when you have safety and certainty of financial independence. So I took that to heart. The way he thinks about that is a mental model I try to use, which is thinking about your life as a mosaic. So it's one big picture. It's beautiful. It makes sense. It's your life. And the things that you do are tiles. And when you're working, you've got that one big tile in the center called work. And when you get rid of it, you have this big hole, and there's no need to fill it with something giant, with a next bigger, better thing. The idea is find the little things that you like to do that represent these tiles. And anything that's in your picture that isn't beautiful or useful to you or doesn't serve the broader picture, throw it out. And that's allowed me on some levels, these are difficult things to enact, but have allowed me to lean into doing a project. Like my wife and I learned to sail last year. We went to Bahamas. We're certified sailboat captains. Don't know if we'll ever use it. It's not the most important thing in the world. In some ways, it's the least important thing in the world, but it was something we took on. Didn't cure cancer, didn't solve world hunger, didn't cause world peace, but we learned to do something new. I learned to cook pizza last year, which is something I'd always wanted to do. Just a tiny little thing. It's just a little tile I've got in my mosaic now. So I give him credit for that. Also, thanks to my anonymous Twitter account, I've made a lot of good relationships. A lot of people have reached out who are in similar situations. There isn't a playbook. People address the situation in different ways, shapes and forms, but always useful to be able to hear from someone who has at least been down the same road and ask the same question. Why am I not happy? I got everything I wanted. Why am I not happy?
Oh, that's so good. It's really interesting you mentioned that from the book about finding little pieces rather than giant projects. I mean, this is a totally different, you know, side of things, but I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, about 6 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, and fortunately it went well and stuff like that. But in the process after treatment, when we were kind of recovering and trying to figure out, okay, who am I? Mm. And Lauren and I as a couple, who are we? You know, our youngest son, Peter, was 2 weeks old when we found out, never saw this coming, wasn't on the horizon. So it hit us like a ton of bricks. And what's funny is what really helped me find myself was kind of remembering that I'm a human being, not a human doing. And we'd had 3 kids in 4 years. I was working all the time. And so as almost stupid as this sounds, the best thing that helped me find myself was spend 20 minutes a day just reading about Kansas State football. Mm. Just get back into little hobbies mm-hmm. that in the grand scheme of life seem really meaningless.
Yeah.
But it's little enjoyable things that make life fun, that make up who you are. So it's funny you mentioned that. I was not expecting that answer. And so I connect with that on a different, you know, avenue, but very much connect with that.
It's a very wise point. And I won't share all the stories, but in his book I looked up is called What Happens When You Get What You Want, Success and the Challenge of Choice. And it's you know, for me, it was very useful. I do have friends that have been in similar situations that can play golf every day. And I mean, every day, 7 days a week. And when they're not playing golf, they're talking about tomorrow's round of golf or the shot they hit on 18. And I like to play golf, but shoot me if I play golf every day. I don't want to do it. So everyone, you know, run your own race. But that was a really useful piece of advice for me. And I'll mention one more that might be useful to your audience that I don't think is in Rick's book, but we stumbled on together, was a list of subroutines my brain was running. And there are certain habits you develop. I ran a security software company. So you can imagine one of the things that's really important in that position is snooping out anything that's broken or wrong or imperfect and fixing it right now. And that's a skill that served me well while I was working. Now you can imagine retirement, going on vacation with that guy. And, you know, we're, you know, you're checked into the suite at the Four Seasons and I'm worried about, I don't know, some stupid little thing that's imperfect. It's, you know, not only is it not that habit not serving me well, it's actively working against me. And optimization, deferred gratification, getting through one task and getting to the next task is something that's very important when you're running a software company. And it's terrible when you're retired. It's terrible. So it's not a solution. I haven't fixed this yet. It's hard to redo your subroutines and your programming that's burnt into that chip in your brain. But when it starts happening, at least now some of the time I can see it and I think, oh, okay, that's deferred gratification. I'm deciding to wait to not enjoy something that I can enjoy today. Or, oh, that's optimization. I don't need to optimize, you know, where I park. I don't need to save, you know, $5 parking in the remote lot. That's something that I don't need to do anymore. That's working against me. So those were the two things that I think were the most useful for me out of close to a year of therapy.
I love that thought. That's so good. And we will link to that book in our show notes. So it will be available there. As we wrap up, retired founder, where can our listeners find you or follow more of your thoughts?
I guess Twitter would be the best spot. I've got a hokey website at retiredfounder.com where I just kind of spat out a stream of consciousness that's actually introduced me to a lot of interesting people. But the X Twitter platform is the place that's easiest. I'm not terribly popular. I think I've got 1,600 or something like that followers. Maybe 100 of them are actually retired founders. And I do read my messages. So if anyone wants to compare notes, love to compare notes. I don't have all the answers, but I love comparing systems and strategies with people who've been down the same path.
I love it. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And until next time, we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. You can subscribe or connect with us at brownleewealthmanagement.com or send ideas for future episodes to podcast@brownleewealthmanagement.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed during this show or episode should be viewed as investment, legal, and tax advice. If you have questions pertaining to your specific situation, please consult the appropriate qualified professional.